This is a wonder to me to be able to call or text or email Michael in the middle of the week or towards the end of the week and have something so beautiful arrive on Sunday morning. So our 11 and 12-year-olds, some of whom you saw up here this morning, are going to begin a new curriculum next week called Amazing Grace. And Amazing Grace is a study of right and wrong, a consideration. And so Amazing Grace intends to help sixth graders understand right and wrong and to act on their new understanding. Its purpose, according to the curriculum writers, is to equip them for moving safely and productively through the middle and high school years, when they will be continually tugged toward both ends of the ethics continuum. So, in the interest of creating an environment of shared learning, I want to invite us all to play one of the games that our young people will be participating in their very first week. You'll remember that this month's theme is humility. There are very few things as humbling as reliving our adolescence, right? So the game is called Wall to Wall, and when they play it, they will be moving from one side of the room to the other, no standing in the middle. They'll be asked a question, and they have to choose this side or that side. So we'll adapt that slightly, and I will invite you to use your right hand for yes and your left hand for no. So when I ask you a question, if you agree yes, right hand. If you agree no, left hand. Here are some of the questions. Right and wrong are what your parents and families say they are, yes or no? What your parents and families say they are. Two hands is illegal. Good job. Oh. the rebel among us. Right and wrong are what God says they are. Yes or no? Interesting. Right and wrong are what your religion say they are. Yes or no? Okay. Right and wrong are what your peer group says they are. Wow, pretty bold individuals here. Right and wrong are what the law says they are. Huh, interesting. Right and wrong are what you say they are. So now I want you to consider, was it easy or hard to make up your mind about which hand to hold up? Easy or hard? Hard? Some hard, some easy. Were some choices easier or harder than others? Okay. Are there certain situations where right and wrong are defined for you and you don't have a say? Does age or other identities such as gender, ethnicity, or ability have an effect on who decides what is right and wrong? Yes. And lastly, when you chose which hand to raise, did you make your own decision? Did you look around to see where other people were going first? Is it okay to see what other people think before you act? It's not always easy, is it? This right or wrong, even if we are beyond adolescence, sometimes those choices don't get any easier. We are in this time of assessment right now. Perhaps we are always are to a certain degree, but when the seasons change, when light shifts, when our schedules shift a little bit, when our calendars adjust from summer mode to autumn, and as for our Jewish friends, for example, the holidays may remind us that the book of life is open and we are being judged, perhaps, or judging ourselves, or at the very least, assessing ourselves. We are called to reflection, and it's a good time to think about our place in the order of things, how we choose, if you will, to be engaged in the world, and not just individually, but as a community of seekers. How do we want to be here in this life at this particular time? How do we want to use our own sense of right or wrong? Our Joha story this morning with our donkey and our father and son presented us with the same question, to a certain degree, as our wall-to-wall questions. Who chooses what is right for each of us? It's easy to laugh at poor Joha and his son, who were victim to the snarky responses and heckling of their neighbors, laughing behind his back, pointing fingers. He is trying hard not to look the fool, and ultimately feels entirely foolish as a result. How many of us can relate to this quandary? Finding ourselves in environments, perhaps, where everybody else seems to know just what to do, or just what to wear, or just how to behave. And we didn't get the memo. And then our words from Thoreau, who would have us know not only the imperative to follow our own hearts in discerning right from wrong, but the imperative to act on our hearts' choices as well. Thoreau wrote the essay Civil Disobedience partially in response to his having been arrested for not paying taxes. Many of you may be familiar with this story. Thoreau observed his tax dollars supporting both the institution of slavery and the Mexican War, both of which he found abhorrent. Having chosen not to pay his taxes, he was arrested and spent a night in jail. You may be familiar with this story about Emerson going to the jail to pick him up and asking, "Henry, what are you doing in there?" And Thoreau's response, "The real question is, Ralph Waldo, what are you doing out there?" How, when we know the errors of our institutions, can we not object and can we not respond? I, for one, have kept paying my taxes, and sometimes I wonder why. As a little bit of an aside, there was apparently some question as to what Thoreau intended by civil disobedience. It was a new term at the time. Did he infer that the disobedience would be a polite one, a non-confrontational one, perhaps? We're going to have a civil disobedience at 3 o'clock today. Bring tea, perhaps. No, in fact, it was that the disobedience to the state, the government, was what he meant, because the relationship between the state and the governed was somehow askew and required individual response. We know, ironically, that Thoreau was not a churchgoer. He spent his Sunday mornings, like many of us, looking for the right mountain, wandering around the right pond. Like Emerson, he had parted ways with organized religion. So we might wonder how his story relates to us here in this sanctuary, in this house of worship, when the influence of our choices of right and wrong, determined by faith at any rate, are constitutionally separated from our civic engagement, right? We can't impel our faith's choices onto the political stage by definition. So the question becomes how we, as a faith community, determine our imperative to respond to society's ills, to what is right and wrong. Or do we? Is it okay for us to encourage individual reflection alone, an individual response to what we determine as wrong? Is that enough? There is likely a wide range of perspective about whether our reaction to right and wrong should be a collective action. Some of us have all that we can manage right in our own backyards, and we want our church to be a place of respite and rejuvenation. Some of us feel compelled to take on the world's ills, and we want our church to be a coordinated environment of robust social change. Most of us are likely somewhere in the middle. I shared the comment last year from E.B. White, "I arise in the morning torn between a desire to improve the world and a desire to enjoy it, and this makes it hard to plan the day." how much harder then to coordinate our efforts beyond the contemplative. Is there really a place for us as a congregation to take action on what we deem right or wrong? I offer this morning's gospel reading as a perspective I'd like to encourage us to consider. It's from the book of Matthew, one of the synoptic gospels, the three that are similar in stories and tone, though unique to themselves. In a Bible study class last week, Unitarian Universalist minister and Bible scholar, the Reverend Carl Scovel, suggested that there are three ways to read Scripture, and by that I'm confident he meant any Scripture, not just Christian or Hebrew Scripture. First, as literature. Second, as history, as perhaps critical history. And third, reading to discover the life behind the text, which is how I would like us to think about this morning's reading. What does it offer us in the context of our question about what to do when we determine for ourselves that something needs attention? John the Baptist, who was the John referred to in our reading, had preceded the arrival of Jesus on the scene, announcing, you remember, that there was someone who was going to change the order of things, that a prophet was going to come along who would give hope to the disempowered, who would offer a vision of a more loving and peace-filled world. The prostitutes and the tax collectors heard the news and believed it could happen. Somehow the vision of hope changed them. One wonders if that's because prostitutes and tax collectors may have been considered the most challenged in that society, the lowest on the ladder, if you will. The two sons, who we imagine may have been somewhat more comfortable in their lives, were far more ambivalent. When directed by their father to go into the vineyard, the first said, no, he didn't think he'd go. But then, in fact, he changed his mind and went. And the second said, yes, he'd go, but he didn't. Neither of them appeared to have a burning sense of doing the right thing, though I suppose the one who changed his mind and actually went was a little more convincing than his brother. The point is, they had no compelling vision of what their purpose was, of how their father's request would contribute to making a better world around them. The parable suggests that this man, John, comes along and says life can be better, and yet, unlike those with more to lose, like the prostitutes and the tax collectors, they didn't believe it, and their ambivalence deserved the world. Our children, as we heard earlier, are going to be challenged with lots of questions this year, learning about their own capacity to choose between right and wrong, not just for the sake of knowing it, but because ultimately they will be presented with choices about what they're willing to do about it. They will be asked to consider, for example, the following conundrums. You are planning to stay at a friend's house when your parents go away for the weekend. You find out that the friend's parents are going away too. They think the friend is staying with you. Your friend says not to tell anybody. What do you do? Remember, you're 12 or 13. You know that a friend got a bad grade on a test at school. You also know that the friend is telling family members and other kids that the grade was much higher. What do you do? And they are going to be reminded that their choices, not just individually but collectively, have an impact on the kind of world we live in. In the extreme, if we all cheat and lie, then we live in a world of liars and cheaters. Or less dramatically, if we all act only on our own behalf, then we have no common good. We need to be reminded that that is not the world that has to be. We can do better. We can create better, and a vision can guide us. I was asked to speak recently at the opening of a new climate justice initiative, a group called Mass Power Forward, which is a collaborative of more than 80 climate justice groups across the state that will be working on behalf of smart and sustainable energy planning. Make no mistake, I suggested to them, that energy policy and economic choices are matters of faith. We are accustomed to thinking of the dollar and the divine as mutually exclusive, but that is not so. It is not a matter of following our heart's calling or financial gain, but of prioritizing smart and efficient and cost-effective choices that will respect our place on this planet and care for its keeping and all its creatures. I mentioned our familiar separation of church and state earlier this morning. We're all familiar with the idea that our churches are free from government-imposed influence and vice versa. But that amendment does not exonerate us from the moral imperative to work for the vision we have of a better world, a safer world, and a more thoughtful and just world. Every choice we make is a matter of the spirit, of the inner voice that informs our ability to know right from wrong and do something about it. That's why we're using this curriculum with our children here at this church, at this faith community, in this place of the spirit that is only one place where our hearts and souls are constantly engaged. 150 some odd years ago, this congregation supported its minister in his vision of a more just and peace-filled world. And we carry his name and we see his bust as a reminder of that vision and that boldness. Only this morning on Krista Tippett, I heard his words invoked again. The arc of the moral universe bends towards justice. Undoubtedly, many decisions were made between then and your more recent vote 10 years or so ago to be a welcoming congregation, making a public statement of welcome to another socially oppressed community because it was right, not because it was popular or easy. You did not wait to see how you should be riding the donkey or carrying it. The question becomes how we are carrying our vision forward today. Mary Oliver asked of us, what is it you plan to do with your one wild and precious life? So I ask all of us together, what is it we plan to do here in our time? We are guided by a shared vision to nurture and strengthen each other with love, and to promote justice with compassion. We have the vision. We have a sense, I think, of right and wrong. On behalf of our children and our world, we must ask ourselves now, what will we do? I trust it will be a robust conversation. So may it be.